recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review with Juranov. Welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download and decide to listen to a show. Today, we have a real interesting show. We're talking about controlling legal malpractice and other risks in e-discovery. And we've got an eclectic group here. We've got David Kramer on the show from the Oswald Companies based in Cleveland, and Ron Hedges, who's an electronic discovery consultant and former magistrate judge from New Jersey, joining us on the show to talk about e-discovery and bad things that can sometimes happen and where the risks are. You know, are these risks business related? Are they ethical? Are they loss of license, you know, when bad things happen? So we're going to go through a couple of fact scenarios that have happened and talk about these risks. What is unique about this show is I'm not sure how much David Kramer has to say, because he knows about legal malpractice, but he's not an electronic discovery expert. In fact, you know, David's background is he's the vice president and practice leader for Oswald Companies, lawyers' professional liability practice. And that practice involves program placement, coverage analysis, risk management, and claims consulting. David works closely with other Oswald Companies personnel to create, integrate risk management and insurance solutions for law firms. Before joining Oswald, David worked for a national broker specializing in lawyers' professional liability insurance and acting as general counsel. Prior to to working in the insurance industry, he worked as an attorney at two very large Detroit area law firms and at the Washington, D.C. office of Cleveland-based Squire Sanders and Dempsey. And David lectures and talks frequently about lawyers' professional liability. So not a lot of e-discovery in there, but you know the risk of malpractice. So I'm glad to have you on the show, David.
Glad to be here.
Ron, of course, is one of my serial participants. Ron knows a lot about e-discovery. He's a former U.S. magistrate judge in the District of New Jersey from 1986 to 2007, and now he's the principal of Ronald J. Hedges, LLC. He served as a special master, mediator, and arbitrator. He's a member of the advisory boards of the Sedona Conference and of the Advanced e-Discovery and Corporate Counsel Institutes of the Georgetown University Law Center, where he serves as an adjunct faculty member teaching on e-discovery and evidence. So, Ron, I'm glad to have you on board here for another show. This is your third show with us.
Thank you, Carl. I appreciate the opportunity.
So why don't we jump right in and talk a little bit about malpractice. I remember a couple of years ago at one of the Georgetown conferences, one of the national e-discovery experts stood up there and said we might see a lot more malpractice in e-discovery as this field grows. So that's why we're having this show, is to talk, you know, is this a real risk? Because we frankly haven't seen a lot of decisions with malpractice yet, or any that I know of. So David, we're starting off, what is the standard of malpractice?
Well, malpractice in the legal context is a little bit different than for other professions, because what we're talking about is negligence, and negligence is based on a standard of care. And while in other professions like the medical profession, there is an accepted standard of care, in the legal field, it's much harder to pin down. There is not necessarily one accepted standard of care. So the elements are proving that there is negligence, in fact, and then whether the negligence was actually approximate cause of the alleged injury, and then proving damages. Those are really the three main prongs of proving legal malpractice.
How, in your experience in this field, how does most malpractice occur when lawyers are involved?
Well, there are a few different areas. In fact, I'm looking at the American Bar Association profile of claims over the last 3 or 4 years, and it's pretty consistent with what the studies have shown for several years, which is that about half of claims come in what you'd call substantive errors. This can be everything from failure to know the law to just making an error, inadequate discovery, which, by the way, is about 8% of claims in the last study. And then the other 50% fall into both administrative errors and also intentional wrongs. About 13 or 14% of claims are fraud, libel, slander, etc. And then the other 35% or so, the administrative errors, are the ones that we really spend a lot of time working with clients on, because those are the things that are correctable, or at least theoretically correctable, with risk management. And those would be failure to dock it properly, conflict of interest, lost files, other calendaring errors, etc.
David, go ahead, Ron.
Well, I was just going to say, just listening to what David said, it strikes me that there may be an area that we may see this in the future, and that is that law firms are beginning to bring, or a number of firms have brought, different types of processing work in-house. And I'd be curious, David's thoughts about whether that would be an administrative problem if a firm fails to undertake its processing or review work correctly, or is that just a discovery issue? Or how would you see that?
I would imagine that it is a higher exposure to the law firm, and obviously whether there's merit or not, in this economic climate in particular, clients that are aggrieved or are suffering economic hardship are going to look to the law firm and try to find exposure where the deep pockets lie.
Okay. Yeah, and I think we'll touch on that point in a little bit in the podcast. And if we run across areas in the sort of the little vignettes we're going to talk about where a lawyer thinks maybe they might have committed malpractice, at what point should they put their carrier on notice, especially in e-discovery where there aren't any cases that we know of yet? I mean, what do they do when they think they have a problem?
We counsel our clients to let us know as soon as possible, and that's consistent with what insurers will tell you. There's a difference in this field between what's considered an incident and an actual claim, and insurers want to hear promptly about both. An incident would be something where there's not actually a suit filed or a demand for payment, but a circumstance under which a claim may arise in the future. And insurance companies, because it's not their job to pay out money unless the contract dictates that they have to pay out money, are going to be real hard on law firms who knew about a specific situation but chose not to tell the insurer at the appropriate time.
Okay. All right, let's jump into the first vignette, which I think everyone thinks about as being a potential area where we might see lawyers' misconducts being investigated, is the Qualcomm type of a scenario where relevant ESI is missed. Who knows which side did it? It wasn't produced to the other side. That much is known. And for example, if an attorney is simply not keeping their eyes open and information is missed due to oversight, you know, that's a bad thing. But does that, you know, rise up to malpractice? You know, what do you think about that type of a situation, Ron? And are these risks real?
Well, certainly Qualcomm is the perfect example of a nightmare for outside counsel. We don't know what the outcome of that is going to be because the proceedings are sealed now. But essentially for the audience, we have a dispute between outside counsel and inside counsel and the client as to who is responsible for discovery not having been provided. And the information that the discovery would have been produced really becomes known during the trial on direct and cross-examination. And a lot of bad things happen to Qualcomm as a result of that. So I could easily see a situation where a lawyer just talks to the client, is told something, is assured, and does nothing, or a lawyer forgets to ask.
Yeah.
And that could also be part of the situation. So I think there are any one of a number of possibilities that Qualcomm can spin off from a malpractice point of view.
Yeah,
and David would know that more than I do.
Yeah, and from the little that I've read, it seems like the judicial decisions as well as the rules, both state and federal, put an affirmative obligation on the law firm to manage the e-discovery process with their clients. So I'm not sure that they can just shrug their shoulders and say, my client's problem, not mine.
Yep, Zubelake came down very clearly on that, and a lot of other cases have found that same position. So someone's got to be in charge, outside lawyer. Okay, well, let's go ahead.
I suppose the question is, though, going back to something David said before, what's the standard of care in the area? Now, we've had a couple cases developing that talk about what the obligations of counsel are with regard to the client and whether an attorney can rely on assurances from a client. And I suppose I would ask David, if you're aware of anything in the malpractice area about a standard of care, what can a lawyer rely on?
It's a good question. And to be quite candid, I don't know if that standard has been set.
I've never seen any malpractice cases in the area, but certainly there have been some decisions where attorneys are taken to task, as you mentioned before, Carl, as early as Zubelake, for not having assumed the responsibility on a certain area of discovery.
Yeah, and another profession that might show some guidance on this is the auditors, who rely on something that a client says when they're asking and they're looking for backup on something. I mean, you can't look at everything. So you're right. I guess the facts would determine, you know, what seems ugly enough that maybe you should look further.
Well, I suppose something else that's coming in this area, I think you see somewhat of a disconnect between the knowledge that people within a firm may have on electronic systems. I think it's fair to say that there may be some senior attorneys in firms that are really not familiar with this and defer to younger people, younger associates, to deal with issues. And I guess that's a question back for Dave. Within a firm, where do you look when you decide whether someone's breached a duty? Is it the firm overall? Is it the partner? Is it the associate? Or is there even any law that really talks about that much?
I'm not aware of anything that talks about it specifically, but I think that because the client engages the law firm, it's really the firm collectively, and there's definitely some sort of failure to supervise claim if it's just the partner looking back to the associate and saying, his fault, not mine.
Well, let's look
there's an overlap here with ethical questions, Carl, too, so I don't know if you're planning on getting into that, or this might be a good second to talk about it or so.
Yeah, if you want to throw in some ethics, go for it.
Well, I'm going to go back to something that Dave said before, that there's no standard of care. I believe the New Jersey Supreme Court has rejected the idea, for example, that the rules of professional conduct furnish a standard of care that can be used in the malpractice area. But certainly one of the first obligations, probably the most important obligation a lawyer has, other than maintaining confidences, which is also an area for malpractice, I would assume here, is the duty of competence. And it's hard to think where we are in 2009 that the duty of competence doesn't encompass something about an obligation to know electronic discovery is out there and electronic information is out there, and it may be relevant to a lawsuit. So this might be a good place for Dave to talk about the RPCs and what they have to do with establishing standards of care, if they do at all.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. I was just looking at an article that's actually 4 or 5 years old now, but it was put out by the ABA Law Practice Management section, and they asked that very question. All of the states have ethical rules that require competence and diligence in a particular area that an attorney's practicing in, and I'm not aware of anything specifically that outlines what type of competence an attorney needs to have in the electronic discovery area, but I think more and more, as this becomes more mainstream, there's certainly an argument to be made that failing to understand the process completely does not comport with the relevant standard of competence that attorneys need to maintain.
Yeah, Carl, we are starting to see some decisions, and one by Paul Grimm, a magistrate judge in Baltimore, that talks about the interplay between the federal rules as well as generally the obligations that attorneys have to be forthcoming and the like. So I would think this might be an area that we're going to see developing in the future.
I would agree.
That's true. All right. The next sort of fact area is auto deletes, and you have when companies are dealing with their electronic records, sometimes, particularly with email, they will delete email automatically at a certain period of time. And if that is not disabled within an IT system and an adequate record holds put in place when there's a potential for litigation, who's in charge, who's responsible for that, and could that rise to malpractice?
Dave, you want to start with that one?
I'll let you start on that one, actually.
All right. I think you could look at this a couple ways, Carl, and we mentioned this really quickly before we started. The first issue is in the context of implementing a litigation hold. If I, for example, am telling you, the client, that you need to do certain things to preserve relevant information, one of the things I would expect I would need to do would be to go to you and say, you have all this ESI, electronically stored information, you have email and the like. When does it disappear, which is effectively what you're talking about when you're hitting the auto-delete? And I would think that I, as an attorney representing you, need to get a grasp on your IT systems to some degree to counsel you to turn off the records destruction. And all we're really talking about here is implementing a records retention or records destruction process. So that would be my first start. And then the second one would be, if I was just consulting with you to create a records retention policy, what would I want to put in there to try to avoid the situation where a computer system does its auto-delete and does that in a way that violates a litigation hold obligation? So I could see an attorney involvement in that from a malpractice setting in two ways, litigation-specific and design of a system-specific, if you would, overall.
I would just add, in reading from a judicial decision in New York, courts have held just that. I'm reading language here that says, counsel must oversee compliance with the litigation hold, monitoring the party's efforts to retain and produce the relevant documents. So there is an affirmative obligation there on the law firm.
That sounds like Zuba-like.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we...
But, you know, having said that, though, there are... Zuba-like never went up to the Court of Appeals. Zuba-like, for those of you on the podcast not familiar with it, is one of the leading cases on electronic discovery obligations and problems. But it is, after all, a decision by one judge in the Southern District of New York, and there are some articles that are suggesting that Zuba-like maybe unintentionally really put more obligations on the outside counsel than belong with them. Because I believe at some point in Zuba-like there was a suggestion actually that outside counsel should see that any type of laptops or whatever are effectively mirrored and maintained by the attorney as opposed to being maintained by the client.
Yeah, I was just talking to an attorney in another state about that exact issue, and this attorney was going on about, why do I have to be bound by Zuba-like? I don't agree with Zuba-like. It's not in my jurisdiction either. but you know, it's out there, and it's the one. It's very visible, so it sets the standard. So you're stuck
looking
at it, at least.
Yeah. It was decided when, 2003, 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say those were the dark ages of e-discovery, but that was really one of the leading decisions. That's Judge Shinlin wrote that, and Judge Fatchell in D.C. wrote a very early opinion. There are some other ones out there. But those are generally the standard because those were the leading cases, and that helped develop this entire field of discovery and law.
Well, let's go into the next issue. Let's dare to tread where angels dare to tread, okay? Search and retrieval. There's been a number of opinions recently that have taken lawyers to task for not being able to articulate and defend their search and retrieval process. And there's also been a lot of research on how poorly keyword searching by itself does to find data. So you're more likely going to find too much if you try to broaden your keywords. Your precision's going to be off. So, you know, with this very messy area, if an attorney doesn't follow proper methodology and puts together sloppy or poorly thought out search terms, can this rise to the level of malpractice? Ron,
David? Well, okay. There's a lot going on here, and to some degree it's driven by what David mentioned earlier, and that's the economy, that my conversations with other attorneys, generally speaking with clients, the mantra from everyone these days is save money, be more efficient, and then, by the way, I want a set of eyes to look at every document before it goes to the other side. It's getting impossible to do that with the volume of electronic information now. And there is a big drive afoot, and I think you alluded to this, Carl, to create the search mechanism. I don't think there is any one search technology that's going to be out there ever that everyone's going to leap at. But certainly the case law, and if you look now at Rule 502 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, which was adopted a little over a year ago, reasonableness is the key to everything. So I would expect more than anything else, when a lawyer needs to come in and defend searches, the lawyer is going to have to be able to prepare, to be prepared to tell the judge, most likely through a consultant or an expert, that this is what I did, this is why I did it. And the other thing that you're seeing come up here now a lot, there's a big move afoot. And as you mentioned before, I'm a member of the Sedona Conference Board and a member of the that organization, where the concept of cooperation is being espoused as a way to get around the cost and delay of e-discovery, to try to work out agreements with the other side on technologies and the like to do searches. So there's a lot of things that could go wrong here. And then I'll turn it over to David to see his thoughts about that.
Well, I, unfortunately, I don't have a lot to add because we've seen very little on this in the legal malpractice setting.
Yep.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think you're alluding to, Carl, the fact that you need to be able to talk about technology one way or the other. And I'm looking at today's Wall Street Journal. It's got a big article that say why email no longer rules and what that means for the way we communicate. So it's suggesting that email, which everyone has focused on now for years, may be on its way out as a big communication medium. So, you know, how do you search these new media and the like, I suppose, is another question that lawyers are going to have to be thinking about as they go forward with things.
Sounds like our previous podcast we did on social media, Ron.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Well, I don't think we answered the question, but...
No. And from Dave's point of view, since there's no case law on this, you know, I think one of the biggest problems is something that Dave mentioned early on, is that is, what is the standard of care in this area? You know, it's easy to say a lawyer has to be reasonable and act reasonably and the like, but when you look at all the technologies that are available and the way everything's shifting, it's kind of hard to wonder what a lawyer is supposed to do one way or the other. It's like
we get asked that all the time. And yeah. In the insurance industry, there's not a good answer. The answer typically is educate yourself in this area, but that's about it.
Just document reasonable steps. You know, I think documenting is a big part of this because at some point you may have to defend what you're doing. And if you're just winging it, then it's going to be hard to show you were reasonable.
I don't think there's any doubt that in this area, courts are not going to be satisfied with an attorney coming in and just saying effectively, look, I've done it the best I can. I think courts are going to begin requiring more than that. And there are a couple of decisions by Judge Fatjoe I mentioned before and one by Judge Grimm in Maryland that really talk about the need to bring in some consultant who is articulate and knowledgeable about this area, is because laymen include lawyers in this area, as I think David mentioned before. This is just not an area of background expertise for most attorneys.
This one, go ahead. I was going to give you an easier fact pattern, and one which I think we can just take a big club at, okay? You know, an attorney that goes in the court and misrepresents something to the court that clearly stems from ignorance related to IT or ESI issues. You know, for example, an attorney telling a judge they can get that information or get at that information quickly within a certain time period, yet it becomes very obvious at a later time that what the attorney promised really wasn't a good option. you know, can that come to malpractice pretty easily? Is it just bad business judgment?
I don't know. What's Dave thinking?
Yeah, well, that's an awfully fine line, I guess, between doing something that could be construed as fraudulent, malicious, misleading, and just pure negligence.
Well, I mean, let me give you a perfect example where that happened, Carl, and that's in the District of Columbia in the Fannie Mae litigation, where depending on how you interpret the opinion, the attorneys for this government oversight agency made promises to the court. They wound up hiring 50 lawyers to do privilege review, spending 6 or 9% of their annual budget trying to do privilege review, and they never got it right, and they were held in contempt. Now, I suppose that's different than if you're in a situation where in private party litigation, I, as the result of some error I make, wind up having default sanctions entered against my client. That's a monetary loss. But on the other hand, if you're an agency and the problem is the contempt, where do you go from there from a malpractice setting? And is that intentional conduct or just negligent conduct? I mean, that's a whole other issue.
Yep. Well, let's talk about, and I've talked to a number of attorneys about this specific issue recently. What happens if you change the agreed upon form of, or if you change the form of production when producing content to the opposing counsel? Say you strip out all the metadata and you produce documents just as a basic image, a TIFF or a PDF. Maybe that leads to sanctions. Maybe the judge isn't happy. Could that cause you problems from a malpractice standpoint? Say the client wasn't involved in this. You were just doing your normal process.
Should I start with that or Dave?
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the first question I would guess, well, first off, I think 9 out of 10 cases when that happens, the attorneys are going to wind up talking to each other and hopefully, unless there's an inordinate amount of expense involved, resolve that, or go to a judge, and the judge will say, "Come on, guys, do this a different way," or whatever. Every now and then, there are decisions where there are fights about form of production, and form of production are pretty common in reported case law. And I suppose the first question for me would be, if I were the lawyer, did I have that information in some other format that the other side wanted that I should have given him? The worst in that situation presumably is going to happen is that the party is going to be required to produce it again in a different format. And that'll be some expense to the attorney, some expense to the client presumably, but hopefully not in a form of some type of sanction that's going to really bite. But put that aside, that can be an enormous amount of money to go back and produce it in another form, although the costs of that are going down. So I guess I would start, Carl, with the proposition, do I have the underlying information? And if I do, can I rectify my error or whatever it was? And at that point, I suppose it's more a question of fessing up to the client and saying, look, I did this wrong. I should have given them, you know, a load file or whatever. I should have given them native, and I gave them an image, and it's going to cost X dollars. So I don't know where that would go as far as realistically speaking malpractice action. So I don't know if Dave's seen any equivalent of that before, maybe not.
I haven't, but I guess the question would become, was that just a tactical decision, a legitimate tactical decision by an attorney where his hand's being slapped, or is it something more sinister than that, which opens up a larger can of worms to ethical violations and possibly malpractice?
Sometimes it can just be following the process that you're used to following without even thinking, and then it stripped the data aside. That's what we did the last case.
Yeah, you know? And one of the possibilities in here, and I don't know where you address this in a malpractice viewpoint, Carl, is this drive in the federal rules to have some degree of cooperation between adversaries, or at least to talk.
The meet and confer, yeah.
Yeah.
The meet and confer make this moot.
Well, I don't know if it'll make it moot, but what it might do is set it up for early resolution by a magistrate judge or in a district judge, where district judges do scheduling conferences. where the judges present it early on and say, look, you know, there are two ways to produce this information. We can produce it in paper, we can TIFF it, we can do X and Y with it, and we can't agree. And at that point, the judge is probably just going to rule, and that'll be the end of it, as opposed to me, for example, making a unilateral decision to produce it in paper, print it out, when my adversary really hasn't had a chance to focus on the form of production yet. So I can see a lot of permutations to where this could lead people in the malpractice area or just in the litigation area generally.
Let's talk about the point that you raised at the beginning of the podcast with the movement at some firms that now are moving into processing and undertaking the IT responsibilities related to e-discovery. It raises issues of, do they have the appropriate technology, appropriate backup systems, servers, appropriate people to continue that process? Say if one or two people leave, would you still be able to do it? Appropriate hardware, and what happens if you run into problems with processing, hosting, or other IT functions that slow down to the point that information is not being processed in time to meet deadlines or being done with mistakes? I mean, do we see potential issues in that area?
Dave, where do you want me to start with that?
Certainly, I think that if a law firm is falling down on the job in terms of some of those things, then to the extent that there's harm to the client, then there is exposure. It's again, it comes back to standard of care, and if it rises to the level of negligence, and an ordinarily prudent, reasonable law firm wouldn't have fallen down in those areas, and it causes economic harm, then sure.
I suppose something else that's part of this, Carl, is, as I mentioned before, we're certainly seeing a lot of areas where courts are expecting experts to be able to say something. And I don't know Dave's experience in this, but I suppose a related question would be, what's the obligation of the attorney when they go out and hire an expert? What do they need to do in the way of due diligence or whatever to pick the right one, or at least one who does a reasonable job?
Well, the responsibility definitely falls back on the law firm. If you bring in an expert who isn't qualified and falls flat on their face, then I don't think that a law firm can just point the finger and say, sorry, bad expert, not our fault, if the law firm was the one who engaged him in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. So a lot falling on the law firm. And, one other thing that seems to be happening with technology. We've talked about, changing, email being less relevant. Well, that's a change in technology. Concept searching, well, that's a whole new bag of tricks and technology to be implementing. In a changing world, is there more risk possibly to saying, yes, we want to be a technology provider too, and we have 900 lawyers and an IT staff of five?
Well, there's some anecdotal things coming out in news stories or in articles where firms are starting to lose or give up confidential information because they're not managing their systems properly. So, I mean, I'm assuming that's something Carl's seen before where, as part of some structural problem, a firm lets confidences go away. And certainly to the extent you're talking about new shared technologies and the like, you run a risk of abridging a confidentiality obligation that a party has, that an attorney has.
I guess the point I wanted to ask maybe David is, are you then held when you've moved into a new area to the accepted standard of care of a technology company doing that? Does your law firm standard of care morph into something else?
Yeah, I've seen law firms who get into ancillary businesses to try to be full service to a client get into trouble. I mean, for example, an intellectual property law firm who's filing maintenance fees and annuities on behalf of their client is held responsible if they fall short in that area, even though that probably arguably isn't really the practice of law. If you go out and engage a foreign counsel in a different country or even local counsel in a particular area, there's some vicarious liability for you because the client is hiring you to do whatever the scope of services are that is agreed upon, and you know, whether that isn't necessarily the practice of law, if that's part of the engagement, then they're on the hook for delivering that appropriately.
Okay. Next example is a little bit more straightforward, like making a misrepresentation in court, just losing track of a deadline. You're busy, you've got multiple projects going along, then all of a sudden you realize, hey, I got to produce in this date, and we've got hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes to go through. Where are we? We better throw some more bodies at it. You know, does that raise the potential of malpractice?
Looking in the ABA study, and this is certainly consistent with what we've seen with our clients, there are 25% of claims from 2003 to 2007 that are attributable to either failure to file, failure to calendar properly, procrastination in performance, or failure to react to a calendar. Absolutely. This is an area that is real black and white. If a law firm misses a deadline, the client's going to know about it. The client's going to know about it in plenty of time to react to it. And if there's some sort of loss as a result of it, more likely than not, the client's going to raise an issue that may lead to a malpractice claim.
That's why we all talk about project management. There's a lot that you can't control. You need an outside provider to be helping you with. So,
When you talk about losing track of a deadline, most sophisticated law firms, certainly law firms that have the size and scope to do this, are now making sure that there are multiple sets of eyes on deadlines. So rather than a piece of mail coming in and someone just sticking an Outlook calendar, there's either a docket department that's doing that and then sending it to an attorney or secretary to double check it and put it in their calendar, or even having two people within a docketing department who get this look at it independently and calendar it independently to make sure that there's nothing that's missed.
I just thought of another scenario because it was the first podcast I did with Judge Facciola and Tom French, and I'm about to do a podcast on opting out of e-discovery. Are there risks, do you think, Ron, of deciding not to deal with ESI because you don't want to issue a notice to preserve ESI at the outset because you don't think about it? Or maybe you just want to ignore ESI and pretend it's not there.
Well,
what do you think?
The number one thing I would think, and this has come up before because I've heard about attorneys doing this when I was on the bench and after, is you'd better be careful you get informed consent of your client before you decide to go down that road. Because for better or worse, most information in contemporary litigation is probably going to exist in electronic format somewhere. And it's hard to think that I'm going to reach an agreement with you, for example, Carl, where we agree, for example, in a Title VII litigation, a discrimination case, not to look at any email traffic. Because that's generally where the so-called smoking gun, although I really haven't seen many of them, may lie. So number one would be informed consent. Number two, I just would be very uncomfortable where I'm opting out of a whole area of discovery, whether my client agrees with it or not, at least initially. The other problem with this, of course, is you're bringing it up in the context of a preservation hold, a litigation hold. And that's usually a unilateral decision you need to do with your client. There's really not even somebody else to consult with that much, especially if you may be a plaintiff someday. So have I seen it? Have I heard of it? Yes. Now, whether how that would work in a malpractice setting, that's obviously Dave's thought or Dave's ideas more than mine.
Yeah, my sense anecdotally, just from talking and studying this area, is that this happens not infrequently. And that's one of the biggest problems you hear from people that consider themselves to be knowledgeable in this field, is dealing with an adversary who's not knowledgeable.
And I would also tend to tell you that it would most likely happen more in state than in federal court, just by the nature of the visibility of e-discovery in the federal area now with the federal rules. And a lot of states don't have e-discovery rules or may not be that involved in doing e-discovery. although that's changing.
Be interesting to come up with what the acceptable standard of care is if most people are opting out. What they should be doing, you know, versus what they are doing. So, but it takes time. It takes time for people to get comfortable with something. So that's your problem, Dave.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, one other issue I want to throw out. It doesn't rise to malpractice. It's more on the other end of the page where you with an in-house person who isn't comfortable with this area. They've read about e-discovery, and they're just really concerned that, boy, if I try to play loose here, or I'm better off just giving all my data over. I don't want to run the risk of my license. Do you see any? I mean, that's a bad thing that can happen, even if it's not malpractice. Do you have any sense on that, Ron? You can play the ethics expert here.
Well, I mean, certainly you shouldn't be doing that unless you get some type of agreement from your adversary to protect you from waiver of privilege, if nothing else. Because if you just say, I'm going to give everything to the other side, you're effectively doing something that's called a quick peek, which is done now very rarely, I think, where adversaries go to each other and say, look, we've got a lot of information to turn over. Our client wants us to save the money doing a privilege review. We're not going to do one, or we're going to do a minimal one, but we're going to agree if we turn anything over, we're going to give it back. And not only could that address privilege issues, but that also could raise questions about confidentiality of other information, disclosure of trade secrets, and the like. So I think if you're going to go that route, you have to give some serious thought as to what constraints there are going to be if you do that. And then you've also got a problem that if you do decide to do that with your adversary, as far as the third person looking in is, and that would be, say, in a situation, Dave may go to a court somewhere and say, hey, I don't care what they agreed. They've waived any protections they had by disclosing this information to adversaries. So there's a lot going on by that. I think maybe it started off to be a simple question, Carl.
Yeah.
Unfortunately in this field, that seems to be normally what happens. There's a relatively simple question, and you get a convoluted response out of it.
But the challenge I was trying to aim at is, you know, that a number of people would say, and we've even done some good podcasts on e-scoping a case, that you don't want to be throwing everything into a bucket and handing it over. You want to limit this as much as possible, because the cost balloon and the chance of missing things balloons rapidly the more data you produce. And, you know, what do you run a risk by trying to be more careful that you've not overproduced and miss something versus producing everything?
I think that goes back to what we talked about before, in a sense, and that is what technologies or what searches are you going to do, number one, to find what's relevant that you need to get from your client, and number two, to look at it and decide what is non-privileged that you're going to be turning over. I mean, there's just so much information that can be turned over in the world of electronic information. I think it's really, really important, wherever you're going down this route, you need to talk to the other side and have some transparency with the other side so you avoid situations where you're taken to task or your client's taken to task later on for something that you did.
So some transparency and maybe having some expertise, even if you don't have it yourself, finding an outside law firm or a provider that can help coach you.
I'm not articulating the idea that whenever you're involved in electronic discovery, you need to go and get a consultant. But the consultant, depending on the size of the case, certainly would seem to me to bring a degree of comfort to you as an attorney when you're getting ready to make a production. Although having said that, you know, the consultants make mistakes too. So you could have a gold-plated consultant. The gold-plated consultant just could have made an error, which happened in a recent decision a while ago where some privileged information basically fell through the cracks or something happened and wound up being produced not because of the attorney, but because of the consultant's error or problems or whatever.
One of the last point I wanted to get into is the role of experimenting. This is a field that's evolving. We've talked about some of the changes in the data that's out there. Is it email or is it something else that's driving communication? What are the tools that are being used? And I suppose in anything where you're trying something new, you're experimenting. So what does the risk of experimenting have on malpractice? Do we standardize on bad tools? Do we continue pushing the envelope to try to improve? And when do you run the risk of malpractice? When you are trying something different that you think can help?
It's a tough question. I think lawyers, understandably so, are fairly conservative in nature and not likely to push out into an avenue that they're not necessarily comfortable going down. We find, and maybe this is a poor analogy, but we find that lawyers who are dabblers and are trying to take on matters in areas that they're not well-versed are the ones who end up getting burned the most and the ones that insurers are most reluctant to insure. I don't know if you could make the same, you could extend an analogy and say that law firms who are kind of pushing the boundaries into uncharted waters run the same risk, but I suppose that they do open themselves up for that consideration.
Thanks for joining us to the listeners, and for a complete list of shows, you can visit www.esibytes.com. Remember to visit ESI Bytes to learn tips about electronic discovery and records management before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shineman. Thanks again, and have a nice day.